What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
So then let's consider, first of all, what is a mind in the grip of vicious circles? Well, one of the most obvious instances that we all know is the phenomenon of worry. The doctor tells you that you have to have an operation. And that has been set up so that automatically everybody worries about it. But since worrying takes away your appetite and your sleep, it's not good for you. So the doctor tells you not to worry because he wants you on the operating table in a state of good health, well rested, etc. But you can't stop worrying, and therefore you get additionally worried that you are worrying, and therefore will not be in the right shape to be on the operating table. And then, furthermore, because that is quite absurd and you are mad at yourself because you do it, you are worried because you worry because you worry. That is a vicious circle. So now, can you allow your mind to be quiet? Isn't it difficult? Because the mind seems to be like a monkey, jumping up and down and jabbering all the time. Once you've learned to think, you can't stop. And an enormous number of people devote their lives to keeping their minds busy and feel extremely uncomfortable with silence. When you're alone, nobody's saying anything, there's nothing to do. There's this worry, this lack of distraction. I'm left alone with myself, and I want to get away from myself. I'm always wanting to get away from myself. That's why I go to the movies. That's why I read mystery stories. That's why I go after to girls or anything that you do, or get drunk or whatever. I don't want to be with myself. I feel queer. So, well, why do you want to run away from yourself? What's so bad about it? Why do you want to forget this? Why do you want to become absorbed? Because you are addicted to thoughts. And this is a drug, a real dangerous one. Compulsive thinking, going on and on and on and on and on all the time. It's a habit. So there's a difficulty about stopping that activity. And you really have to stop it if you want to be sane. Because if I talk all the time, I don't hear what anyone else has to say. And then I'll end up in the situation of having nothing to talk about but my own talking. Or so in exactly the same way, if I think all the time, I won't have anything to think about except thoughts. And that's the academic fallacy. See, when you add books to the library, a great many of the books that are added to the library are books about books. They're not necessarily books about life, some of them are, but most of the books, especially PhD dissertations, are books about books about books about books. About books. And that doesn't really get us very far. So in order to have something to think about, there are times when you simply must stop thinking. Well, how do you do that? The first rule is don't try to. Because if you do, you will be like someone trying to make rough water smooth with a flat iron. And all that will do will stir it up. So in the same way as a muddy, turbulent pool quiets itself when left alone, you have to know how to leave your mind alone. It will quiet itself.
I think the fear is uncertainty. I think that's the reason why there is a billion-dollar industry now teaching people how to become more present. And the irony is if we would have been able to live in the present 100,000 years ago in the savannas of Africa, we would have gotten eaten by the lion that we didn't see coming. Living in the present is not evolutionarily advantageous. You know what's advantageous is the fact that we can imagine future scenarios. The reason we have memory, and Jordan Peterson talks about this, is not so we can relish about past times, is so that we can learn from things that happened in the past and make inferences about what's going to happen. Mitigating against future risk was biologically selected for. Those who did that bred more widely. And so we have inherited that brilliant neuroses of foreshadowing future danger and mitigating against it. Problem is, once we've made the world safe, we still are like a hamster in a hamster wheel. It's like you may have money, you may be paying your rent, you maybe have a wife and a kid and this and that, but you're still worried about tomorrow. Like, what's gonna happen? Oh my God, the collapse of the government, a terrorist attack, an airplane disaster. Like, that's the wire. Ironically, we've gotten to a time where now some of the hardware that has served us so well is now problematic, and there's this desire to return to a kind of capacity to be here now and actually like neuter our foreshadowing capacity and a relishing of memory to block the signals forwards and backwards. In fact, in mental health now there is a renaissance. Again, I'm talking about like the rise of learning to be in the present, meditation, mindfulness, all of these tech.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Techniques are teaching us to neutralize our wiring to think about the future. Human beings are like an artificial intelligence program. We take in data from the present. We compare that data with data from the past. And we use that then to make predictions about the future. And that's what we're always doing automatically all the time. In fact, a lot of the time, we dispense with the present data altogether and just leapfrog to the conclusion. And so we're living in this perpetual been theres and seen thats of the adult mind, also known as jadedness. You're not even there. You're like, rather look at your phone, or you're rather, what movie am I going to watch later? Like, we're just never present. Because our brain is so effective at saying, I know what this is, and making predictions about the future. And if the future's not dangerous, then we don't even have to pay attention to what's happening right now. So we live with this kind of perpetual low-level hum of anxiety. This future tense, like we're like crooked, like having a crooked back. We're like future tense all the time. Never now, always future tense, you know? And maybe that makes you a good businessman or a good planner. But unless you're like an architect and you're like planning the structure you're gonna build, like the incapacity to enjoy and smell the flowers is very problematic. What are some of the ways that we can neuter our compulsion to constantly leapfrog to the future? Travel, experiences that violate your expectation. Art, what these things do is they block all signals forwards and backwards. It's hard to know what's about to happen if you're in a place that's completely new. When you're off the reservation, you don't know where that path leads. And when you don't know where that path leads, it's hard to imagine where it leads. So instead, your senses are heightened and you're here now paying attention. And it also answers this dilemma or existential conundrum of what to do about death. Because it's not even that we're afraid of dying tomorrow. We're afraid of dying in 30 years. Like, I'm afraid of turning 90 and dying when I'm 90. Except when I'm traveling, when I'm exposed to great, beautiful art, when I'm making love, what happens is you block all signals forwards and backwards. When you block all signals forwards and backwards, you enter the flow of the present. A present that is literally wonder-full. Wonder being the byproduct of exactly that unencumbered sense of first sight or virginal noticing. So you're obliterating the adult capacity to foreshadow everything. And you're returning to a more virginal state of heightened appreciation for what's unfolding in real time. And that seems to be the answer to our ills. Because when we have those experiences, we have awe. And awe is an experience of such perceptual expansion in the moment that all your mental models about what this is are fucking obliterated. Oh, now I know what a glacier looks like. Oh, that's what a lion looks like in its natural habitat. Like you are dumbstruck, you are awestruck. Even though these are transitory experiences, they leave afterglows. That's why when people take magic mushrooms and have a mystical experience, when they go to the Grand Canyon and they see their child be born, they're left with this afterglow for weeks, months, sometimes even years afterwards, of increased well-being, increased creativity, and increased compassion for other people. Perhaps the answer to the existential agitation of what to do with ourselves in the face of death is simply to stop and smell the roses, to learn to steward the contents of consciousness to the here and now. When we get caught up in like the excessive rumination and overthinking, do not get caught up in routine or patterns of thinking. By exposing ourselves to great art, to travel, to do things new and different, or you know, you're hurled back into the flow of the now.
My notion of human well-being is really open-ended. I don't think we understand what the horizon is, if in fact there is one, for kind of ultimate flourishing of conscious minds. We have a pretty good sense of what we don't want and are right not to want. We don't want to be terrorized and depressed. The generic situation we want to find ourselves in more and more is to effortlessly cooperate with creative and happy strangers, right? I mean, there's 7 billion of us. We need institutions and laws and norms and ways of thinking that take the friction out of pleasurable and non-paranoid interaction with strangers. I mean, it's not just about having, you know, 5 or so close friends who have your back, right? I mean, clearly we're all on the same team on some basic level. And if we can't figure out how to build a civilization where everyone thrives to some degree, we'll have the world we currently have. We're in a situation now where I think it's reasonable to worry that our default state of partisanship and tribalism and rational fear of the incompatible aims of, you know, other groups and other people is unsustainable in the presence of more and more destructive technology. I think we have to get our act together psychologically and socially in a way that we haven't yet. Philanthropy is, when it's telescopic in this way, when you're just signing a check, you're not necessarily connected to the good you're doing. And I can imagine someone doing immense good in the world by signing very large checks, but not actually internalizing the gratification of that. Some level, we have to be aware of the possibility of rowing in two boats simultaneously. Is what the effects are in the world of how we're living. So, you know, we want to have a good impact on others, but we actually want our conscious states of psychological pain and pleasure to be mapped in some rational way to the kinds of effects we're having. Having our beliefs map onto reality to some degree is obviously good, because if they're not, you're just bumping into hard objects. If your map is completely wrong, you are bound to suffer, right? So we have to be in a situation where radical ignorance can't be bliss. It may be useful to have a slightly delusional self-serving bias, right? To think you're coming off better than you are. Well, like, it may give you more enthusiasm for your life, more confidence. That's one principle. So I think we want our beliefs to be true in some basic sense. And therefore, we want to be open to new evidence and better arguments perpetually. If you close yourself off, if you say, well, listen, I'm done thinking about reality, and I know what's true, then again, when more data comes in, you know, when something's surprising, when one of your intuitions proves to be faulty, if you can't error correct, again, you're just going to fall out of alignment with what's going on in the world and with what other people think is true. So really the only mechanism we have to do that is human conversation. We have to be open to having other people point out errors in our thinking. And in the conversation we have with ourselves, we have to do likewise. We have to be continually open to the possibility that we might be wrong, and in fact, we're very likely to be wrong a lot of the time. And so then, you know, then hence the virtue of getting educated and surrounding yourself with smart people and reading good books and just exposing yourself to the kinds of lessons that other people have learned over, you know, thousands of years and are learning in real time. Most of what people care about can be thought of as a skill, right? I mean, well-being is a skill. Not suffering unnecessarily is a skill. Regulating, noticing your emotional life and regulating negative emotion is a skill. So, you know, I have a meditation app, and, you know, meditation is a skill. It's a very useful one. And I'm spending a lot of time teaching, you know, what's now referred to as mindfulness meditation. And the moment you begin practicing mindfulness, which is just learning to pay close attention to the nature of your experience. You're not adding anything to your experience. You're just noticing what it's like to be you moment to moment, but in a way that is not reactive. You're not grasping at what's pleasant or pushing what's unpleasant away. Let's say you have a fear of public speaking, right? So you're about to go out on stage and you feel anxiety. The default state of someone who doesn't want to have that experience is to try to figure, is one, to, you know, in advance worry about that experience. I mean, the anxiety is kindled just by the mere thought of what you have to do. Then once you feel the butterflies, you are at war with them. I mean, first you can notice that anxiety isn't even that unpleasant. I mean, it's so close to excitement in its actual physiology that really the difference between excitement and anxiety is more or less just the framing. It's just the story you're telling yourself. You know, if you felt these tingles and this, you know, slightly adrenalized response right before, you know, you're about to go on a roller coaster, that's part of why you're going on the roller coaster. You like that experience, right? But the fact that you feel that way when you're about to have an interview or you're about to, you know, walk out on stage, that's intolerable. The sense of self for most of us is not a feeling that we're identical with our bodies. Most people don't feel identical with their physical bodies. They feel like they're passengers inside their bodies. Right? They're like, my body's down here. Like, these are my hands, these are my legs. you know, I obviously care about these things. You know, these were my pains and pleasures are coming from, but I'm up here in the head. So much of what we're thinking is making us miserable, right? So much of it is unpleasant. So much of it is causing anxiety. You look at your to-do list. You got 50 things on it. You just feel like, oh my, the day is not long enough. This is the state we're in. And the obverse of that is when we're really just connecting with life in a joyful, creative, beautiful way. Like when you look out the window and it's the most beautiful sunset ever, and you are just looking at the sunset, right? You're not, like, you're fully connected with its beauty. Those are all moments where you're losing this sense of self. You're not really aware of losing the sense of self in those moments. You're not really aware of what is freeing about those moments, and you can't do it in other circumstances. What's happening for people, most people, is that they're waiting for the world to give them a good enough reason to just be present, and to be present so fully that they lose their sense of self, right? That they're no longer behind their face, you know, just waiting for something good to happen, right? Or figuring out how to change the experience enough so that, again, they can stop, they're no longer at war. I mean, we're to a greater or lesser degree, we're always at war. I mean, we're always fighting something. You know, there's always this, like, you know, you're always noticing something wrong. You're feeling uncomfortable in your body. You're reacting to something that somebody did or you thought they did. The moments where you really feel good are moments where there isn't a coming to rest, right? Where it's not about the past or future. You know, it's not about half a second ago, and it's not about half a second from now. And the ultimate version of that is entails the dropping of this sense of self. For me, flourishing is a matter of spending your time pleasantly and happily and creatively. Every moment when someone asks you, well, you know, that last hour, that last day, that last week, that last year, do you feel good about that? Was that a good use of your time? That remembering self, that retrospective gesture, that's where people worry about things like meaning. And the remembering self is the self that you're talking to when you say, you know, are you satisfied with your life? Whether you're asking yourself or someone's asking you. The answers that are available in those moments really determine whether or not somebody has a kind of global life satisfaction, whether they have meaning. But the experiencing self, the self that is just going moment to moment, feeling pains and pleasure, and just dealing with this, you know, very short, you know, time horizon, I think that's fundamentally our real self. Use of negative imagination, where you think of all of the bad things that haven't happened to you. Right? So if you're just, you know, if you're stuck in traffic, driving to the job that you don't like, and you're frustrated, you can think of all the things that could happen to you, right, that haven't. And if any one of them happened to you, you would consider your prayers answered if you could just be returned to this moment, right? Like, you haven't been diagnosed with cancer, right? You've got two young kids, say, you know, you want to live to see them grow up, and you could be the guy who today is going to find out you've got 2 months to live. That's just more thinking, but it can have a profound effect. You can reframe your experience in a way that doesn't actually change anything material about your circumstance, and it can let the light in.
I had a really good friend of mine. I went to lunch, and he said, I don't know who this guy is here in front of me. And he goes, let me ask you a question, honestly. Right now, what are you grateful for? And at the lunch, I said, jack shit, nothing, brother. There's nothing good in my life right now. And I'm not exaggerating this to you when I tell you this, and this is a factual story. As I'm mouthing these words two people walked in with an older man. Both of them clearly were fighting cancer somehow. Both had lost their hair. One of the ladies had a bonnet on, and they were barely moving in. Both walked by our table and gave me the most warm greeting, the warmest smile as a stranger. And he goes, "That's pretty freaking pathetic. You can't find anything in your life to be grateful for right now." And on the drive home, I'm not kidding you, I started to stack gratitude. I started to take inventory, because if you can find things to be grateful for in that space, man, is your life gonna be rich when there really are external things to be grateful for. So my first mechanism out of that space was honestly to stack the things I was grateful for, and I started reinforcing it over and over and over again. And what happens is there's this reticular activating system in our brains, right? And all of a sudden, because that's the messaging I was giving myself, all of a sudden, all these things start to come into my awareness that I'm grateful for. I start to magnetize to myself some people that I needed to find into my life, and that was the next layer. I started to see things to be grateful for: my health, my fitness, people who loved me. And what it did is it changed my state. When I stacked gratitude, I changed what I did in the morning, and I changed what I did in the evening. And so somehow, by grabbing control of my morning and by grabbing control of my evening, I got some measure of control over the middle of my day. I was an out of control person back in those days, meaning this: I woke up worried, stressed, fearful, and I immediately start thinking about a bill I had to pay, something that was wrong, and I'm in a state of reaction to begin every, I'm talking within 6 minutes of waking up, 6 seconds. Most people listening to this, that's what they do. I said, I gotta grab control of my morning, and I set up routines in my morning. Maybe they served me, maybe they didn't, but they were things I could deliver on doing for myself. That which you do not hate, you will eventually tolerate. And I think that identifies most people's lives. In other words, they average becomes sort of like this slow asphyxiation. It's almost like an anesthetic. And that over time, we become kind of immune and dulled to the average that we're becoming. I know this is true, at least for me. You probably experience it yourself too. And so over time, we sort of minimize where we're at. In other words, I'm a little pudgy instead of being, no, you're a fat ass, right? You don't magnify the degree to which the pain ought to be affecting you. And so really what he means in that is, listen, you're gonna get out of your life what you'll accept. And that's really difficult for people, I think, to understand, is look, what you think you're worth and what you're gonna tolerate is absolutely what you're gonna bring into your life and what the outward part of your life's gonna look like. And so I live by that. Like, I let myself sort of feel the pain and the difficulty of being not where I wanna be in whatever that area is, whether it's my spirituality, my relationships, my money. I let myself feel that pain, because as you know, there's two motivators, right? There's the gaining of pleasure, right? Wanting to go get something, chasing the dream. But then there's the avoidance of pain. And for a lot of champions, that's a pretty big driving force for them. And so at least for me, I leverage both of those things on me to get myself to take action. So this thing people think that, like, I'll be happy when. Once I get like this big amazing home, or once I get this car, or once I get this relationship or an amount of money, then I'll allow myself some happiness. The problem is the finish line always moves. You never arrive there, right? The other part is people think, well, if I enjoy myself now, I'm gonna lose my drive. In other words, if I can just wire myself with enough pain all the time, I won't lose my drive or ambition. The truth is there's no correlation between the two at all. There's no relationship between you feeling complete pain all the time and losing drive. And so I talk about living in a state of blissful dissatisfaction. And really the best example of that would be like, if you've ever, I love a good meal, right? You know, if I bite into a great piece of steak, if you're a steak eater like I am, you take that first bite, it's like complete bliss, right? There's no correlation between how great that tasted and your lack of desire for the next bite. In fact, that bliss causes you to want more of it. And so the more we can begin to reward ourselves with bliss, we're not gonna lose our dissatisfaction. We're not gonna lose that. And so for me, our brains, this dopamine hit you get when you do something successful, if you constantly cheat yourself out of that hit, right, biomechanically in your body, less and less in the future will you want to achieve the next level, the next dream, the next step. And that's why so many people stall out in life. They got to a certain point and they cheated themselves out of the bliss, out of the celebration. It's important that we celebrate our wins. We celebrate our lives because it causes us to want the next bite. It keeps us hungrier, not the reverse. And so for me, I want to live in a state of being grateful and blissful now, not waiting for some future place or date that may never arise. Self-confidence is really self-trust. So the first thing is, the people I know that are really happy are very self-aware. In fact, the best entrepreneurs I know are very self-aware. They're aware of their shortcomings, right? They want to improve them. They want to get to the next version of themselves all the time. And so for me, self-confidence comes because I didn't have it. And I think anytime you meet somebody like yourself or myself who might now appear self-confident, it's because I really had to find tools and resources because I was so insecure and shy and introverted. So I had to find techniques and resources to build that up in me. And for me, it's very simple. It's the promises that I keep to myself. If I have a habit over and over of beginning to stack one on top of the other of keeping promises I make to me, not other people. In other words, the minute you begin to get external in your life, worrying about what other people think about you, right? You've lost all control. And it never fills you up. And people's admiration, people's gratitude towards you will never fill you up. It's your own. It's your own inside. And so for me, self-confidence comes from keeping the promises I make to myself. And the other part of it is being aware I'm doing it. In other words, most people don't give themselves enough credit all the time. They're very aware of these 20% things and not aware of the 80, right? And that's why the dosage is so important too. You've nailed it. It should be 80-20, right? Because people get addicted to this. I'm not good at this. People don't like this about me. I don't feel good. Instead of focusing on the 80 and stacking it up, wow, I did eat what I said I was going to today. I did get up when I said I was going to. I made the amount of phone calls. I treated people in such a way I promised myself. It's not just doing those things. It's rewarding it. It's being aware of it and stacking that up. When I work with athletes, the successful athletes I work with, when they're in a slump, it's never that they can't hit a ball anymore or make a shot or swing a golf club. They've lost their self-confidence. Somewhere along the way, they've lost the ability to focus on the things they are great at and stacking those promises they make to themselves. And the way I get them to break their slump is not correcting their swing or getting them positive. It's getting them to acknowledge the small promises, showing up to batting practice early, hitting that extra bucket of balls, beginning to reward themselves for the extra promises they keep to themselves, puts them back in a state of self-confidence. All of a sudden, they're hitting the ball great again.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.